Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with provocateurs, pioneers, and passionate leadership champions. Today, we're with Umaima Abubakar, Executive Director and member of the Management Committee for Mubadala Investment Company in Abu Dhabi. Umaima's human-centric leadership approach deeply resonates with me. I'm impressed with how she and others at Mubadala embrace employee engagement is not only the right thing to do, but because it's key to business success. Her people-first mindset was so evident as she described how they navigated a recent merger or integration, as they purposefully called it. At Gagan, we've helped many clients navigate the murky waters of mergers and acquisitions. It's one of the biggest challenges a leader can face. Today, you're going to hear a fabulous case study on how to do it well. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Welcome to Let Go and Lead. Today, we're with Umaima Abubakar, who is the Executive Director and member of the Management Committee for Mubadala Investment Company in Abu Dhabi. Umaima, thank you so much for joining us.
It is my pleasure, Meryl. Thank you for having me. I was really honored when you asked me to kind of do this. I was like, oh my God, I've always wanted to work with you. So this has been a complete pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it's exciting for me too. You know, I've admired you for a long time and you're watched all your leadership. I know we're both members of the Page Society and you've just stepped up in a key leadership role there with Page Up. So really great to have you aboard here.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Mubadala. It's such an incredible company and I'm sure many of our listeners may not be really aware of the breadth and scope.
Yeah. Mubadala Investment Company is a sovereign investor. We have been around for about 22 years approximately, just getting into 22. We have a global portfolio that's focused around generating sustainable returns for the government of Abu Dhabi. Our portfolio spans across six various continents, and we invest in multiple sectors from life sciences to traditional and digital infrastructure to technology and so forth. We are focused around leveraging our deep sector expertise in various areas and working very closely with partners in order to try and drive sustainable growth, not just for the company, but also for the country as well. And we do so in terms of trying to ensure that we're diversifying the economy of Abu Dhabi.
And I know to that last point that you just made, you know, one of your great focal points is really the growth in the United Arab Emirates, right?
100%, yes. So there are a number of key players within Abu Dhabi that kind of help drive that progress, and we're one of them, and we really focus in terms of trying to diversify the economy, as I said, and finding innovative and creative ways of doing that, bringing in talent to support that development. And I think that's what makes it unique, is because we try to do it in a way that thinks about how do you build your workforce or your talent to the country's capabilities in order to try and get to this vision that our leaders have put forward for us. So it's very exciting.
I think I saw somewhere, I think your assets under management are about $276 billion U.S. dollars.
Very proud of that.
That's staggering.
When we got there, we're like, whoa, is that number real? But yes, it's been a long journey and we're very proud of that growth. And it has been gradual.
No, it's really terrific. So, you know, as you're talking about what you're doing now, like what role do you see Mubadala playing in the future in the global economy?
One of our values is partnership. So we've always been about collaborating with others, but something that really has become core and a part of our narrative in the last couple of years in particular has been about being a convener. So we know we're not going to solve all global challenges. The macroeconomic landscape has become so dynamic. And we recognize that if we're going to play a part, we're going to have to work with others in order to make progress.
And you've really gotten to this point also through merging, right? As I recall, Mubadala merged with IPIC.
Correct, IPIC. Yeah.
And you were a key leader in driving a lot of that transformation and change. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so We merged with IPIC a few years back. Before that merger, we were still a Mubadala development company. And we recognized in order to get to our next phase of our journey, we needed to embrace what we said we were, which was an investment company. But we hadn't fully come to that realization 100% until the name was created. And we said, actually, that's what we do. We are comfortable to wear that brand of sovereign wealth fund organization. Our CEO, His Excellency, Mr. Khaldun Al-Mubarak, was very clear and said, we are integrating, we're not merging. And I think the language in these situations is so super important. He was very clear to us about, as we embark on this journey, there's nothing broken in these institutions. We want to take the best of both worlds and figure out how we become better. And I think that really set the tone right from the beginning in terms of, okay, arrogance will not be tolerated. Assuming that we have priority or seniority in certain decision-making leadership groups will not be entertained. It was about coming together and really thinking about, okay, what can we cultivate, or what can we continue to nurture in order to be a better version of ourselves? And that's the work that I led when we merged with IPIC. We really spent a lot of time thinking about our culture. And that was fascinating. When most people talk merger, they automatically start talking about numbers. We started the conversation with culture. We started the conversation with employees. We started the conversation with our values. And we spent a good chunk of the first 6-8 months focused around that conversation.
And did the two organizations have similar cultures, or were they fairly different?
No, we were so different. So IPIC was around longer than Mubadala was. And IPIC had a very traditional feel to it. It had a very UAE, I want to say royal, but it was a very traditional feel to the organization. They did things in a very traditional way. And it was different. It wasn't wrong. It was just different. Mubadala had a very different feel. When we were integrating at that point, we had always seen ourselves as, we've just matured into this organization, and we feel like we've earned our place to be in this market right now. So we were very much, as I like to call it, in our teenage phase, and therefore we were very doing things very fresh. We were trying to bring in innovative thinking. We were trying to do things in a very progressive manner, and it was just new. It was very global. Whereas I think IPIC, if I had to describe it, was very traditional. Was very regional. That's the best way to describe it. And therefore, we were trying to marry these two very different cultures at the time. And it was like, okay, how do we do this? Because it wasn't just a natural fit into each other. It was we are different. And how do you take out and identify what's unique about both? And so we spent a lot of time as an organization thinking about culture tours. And we spent a lot of time working with the organizations about focus groups and, it was every focus group. There was a deliberate thought process around, this needs to have 50% Mubadala, 50% IPIC employees that sit in these groups. When we did tours, it wasn't just, oh, come and look at the Mubadala premises and location offices. It was like, okay, so we'll do Mubadala tour first, and then we'll do the IPIC offices next. And then people were given like little sheets and like, what do you like as you walk around? Please tick. And it was from everything from like, the reception and how you walk into the reception to like how you're greeted by the reception desk to the carpets to the lounge area. I remember when we were doing this, everyone was like, do we really need to get this detail oriented? I was like, yes, because people are picking what they like. And if we're going to marry the two, we need to go from like the minute level of detail all the way up to strategic deals, investment conversations, deal making process. We can't just go straight into like the big items that are the flashy, visible items. So it was a really interesting exercise to do. And I hope what people will see where we landed was we did live through our promise, which was we're going to try and preserve the greatest things about both institutions. And we're going to try and make sure that the leadership is enriched with both companies' thought process and thinking. And that's, I think, what's helped us get better. I think that's really challenged the thinking around how we operate, who we work with, the way we communicate with one another. I think it really pushed the conversation forward.
And I love your holistic approach because, as we work with clients, we're often talking about culture is so much more than just values or even behaviors. It's the symbols, the systems, the energy of the organization, all those different things. And it sounds like you really tackled all of them.
Meryl, you know this better than anyone. I was in awe of your work for years. Every time I see you, I'm like, exactly, she gets it. You know, it's exactly that. It is the symbols. It is the way you show up, the conversations. It is not just the logo. It is the performance. It's the evaluation. It's that whole, I can't remember the way you look at it at Gagan, but it is that whole
like an ecosystem.
Culture isn't just one thing. And that was, I think, the learning for a lot of, for the institution, which was like, culture isn't just this flashy word that we say, oh yeah, we've got a culture. It's that whole ecosystem. And you, what you say has to be what you deliver and how you show up in everything that you do. And teaching everybody that, I think, was the fun part. And it was, I think a lot of people embraced it because it was like, okay, but we're doing this. I'm like, okay, but does that really exhibit what we say we stand for? And it was challenging people in that way. And people were like, it was like a light bulb going up. It was like, okay, I get it. This is what you mean by the ecosystem and coming together in a way that's mutually respectful. So it was great in that way.
What, as you went through this whole process, is there anything that surprised you in terms of where you landed?
What surprised me, I think, is that we got here so, I don't want to say effortless, because it wasn't effortless, that we got to where we got to in a seamless manner. You know, a lot of the times when you go through mergers, companies, you know, there's definitely tensions, there's definitely friction. It felt very seamless. Once you laid out the plan, and once you aligned everybody to the purpose, and once you explained to everybody the steps it's going to take to get there, it felt like everybody was just on board and everybody was playing their part. And it happened in a very amicable way. It happened in a very respectful way. And I keep coming back to the word respect, because I think that was something that we really tried to preserve. And I think that's what surprised me the most, is that it wasn't like some of the case studies that you hear of various mergers. It was done in a way that felt like this is right, naturally organic growth. And I think that was what surprised me the most. And it was the nicest thing about it, to be honest.
Were there any specific strategies you used that you think would be helpful for others to hear?
Collaboration. I think, you know this, collaboration is the key, right? It's very easy to be like, okay, we're going to merger, finance team do your thing, comms do your thing, the business guys do their thing. For us, the biggest strategy was the sharing. Once a merger was announced, there was a steering committee that was set up. There was a working group committee that was set up, and everybody was tasked with, right, you know, we want to be able to report in every 2 weeks' time or in every month time the progress that was done. Here's a list of all the things that we think we need to do. Can anyone add to it? And it was like, yep, this list feels right. And then it was, okay, now that we all understand the mandate, everyone's got their charge, we need everyone to figure out how we make this happen. And so the working groups, and, you know, it would be the comms group from Mubadala's side and the comms group from IPIC side that would meet regularly, and we'll put together saying, okay, here are the things that have been achieved, to be reporting back to the steering committee next week or next month. And the finance team did the same, and the IT teams did the same. And I think that was, again, another way of getting people to work together. It wasn't something being done in a secret back room and suddenly people were told, like, this is what's happening. The teams were coming together, were working together. So when integration finally happened, we've already been working together for a while. We've already been establishing the boundaries, the ways of working. We've already been establishing the rules until finalized, to get to the final output. And when we had disagreements, we would present it to the steering committee as such. And we'd say, okay, here's the things that have been accomplished. This is the bit that's in amber that we actually are disagreement about, and we need a verdict or a review or approval from the steering committee. And then that was then said, okay, we'll take this away, we'll come back to you. So it was done in a way that I think helped build collaboration, and then more importantly, helped build integration. And I think what was beautiful about that is when we were eventually coming to report back to the steering committee, finance was in the room, you know, HR would be in the room, comms would be in the room, all of the various leaders from the various groups would be in the room. And being comms, you'd listen to the finance things and be like, oh, hang on a second, that's a dependency on what I'm working on, and I'm never going to be able to meet that timeline. And it allowed for easy identification for dependencies, overlaps issues, I think. And I think that's the purpose around it. It's not just about bringing the company together and we have a day one. It's about being able to do this in a way that makes sense when it finally lands on everybody's lap of like, okay, here's day one. It should feel like the lights have just naturally been able to be switched on because someone's already thought about the circuit, the wiring, their covering, you know, the whole ecosystem. So I think that would be my biggest strategy and guidance that I would give most institutions is to think about it in a way that's inclusive and really taking advantage of the experts that you have in the room. They're experts who already know their worlds. You just need to tell them what dependencies that you have, what you need in order to make your deliverables work, and they'll support you. And they're happy to support you because if that works, then their deliverables can work and it's a mutual beneficial outcome. And I think that's key.
And you've mentioned the word integration many times, and you started by saying that you were very clear that this is an integration, not a merger. What do you see as the distinction between the two?
I think it's an excellent question. You've heard a merger tends to be a lot more aggressive. The characteristics of a merger are described in ways that have always been known as the more, hostile takeover or mergers. You know, someone, you know, even though it's a merger, it's always the perception is always a takeover. Integration is a collaboration for me. Integration for me is coming and the unity of two working together for a better outcome. And again, it goes back to the language. If the words that are used in order to communicate the task are appropriate and right, you automatically disarm their critics, the skeptical people, and that's important. If people feel like it's a takeover, one has to play defense, you automatically you don't bring the best versions of people into the workforce because everyone's being on defense. Everyone's thinking about territory. Everyone's thinking about preservation of their ways versus, okay, nothing is going away. We're coming together. How do we make this work in a way that makes sense? I think it just automatically disarms people who are critical of the process.
That's so interesting. And, I was just thinking as you were talking too, I'd love to ask you, as a communication expert, what advice do you have for leaders who need to balance being open and transparent with the need to protect sensitive information? Because I know even as you go through an integration, there's a lot of that that comes up.
It's such a great question. And I see many companies grappling with this today. Once you start to become successful and you grow, we talk about it at Mubadala all the time, back in the days when you could all fit on one floor and our CEO would see everybody and say good morning to. And as you get bigger, communities start to happen and you expand to other floors and you expand to other buildings. And, teams start working on sensitive data because they're working on various deals in our situation. And it would come across sometimes like, this is a need to know basis and you don't need to know. And it was like, wait a minute, if you're working on a deal, surely you need to know the risks and the pros and cons that goes with this deal and this announcement. Surely you need to know the financial backing. And so automatically, as you start to think in that way, you realize actually that there are very few things that are 100% confidential. But if you're going to be successful, you definitely need to allow some level of transparency to a process because that's when you get the best of everybody. I joke a lot with my chief communication officer, Brian Lott, some of you may know, about, sometimes our jobs as communicators is just to reconfirm what's already happening in the rumor mill. And that's because, if you try to keep things confidential, a lot of the times, people, as you work on things, think things get compromised. So if you include people as part of the process and you say, okay, these are things that we can share, but these are stuff that's open and we need everyone's input, I feel like it just manages the conversation better. I feel like you get the best of people. People are more productive when they feel like they're in the know and they're able to look at things in a way that's effective and holistic. And that's, a better outcome. So it is a delicate balance. Obviously, you can't share everything that, as leaders when you're still trying to figure things out. But the more you can share at the right time, the better, because you just get a better output.
And I know you been rated quite highly in employee engagement, or Mubadala has. And you've also been named one of the top companies to work for in the Middle East. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that have contributed to that?
Thank you. And it has been a journey, as I'd mentioned, in terms of being seen as that. And I stress on the word the journey. I remember when I joined the organization 14 years back, it was we had surveys that we were doing, and people be like, okay, the survey is saying a number of things. And I would look at the leadership and say, okay, so does this match what you want? And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay. So like most companies, you did the gap analysis, and you did like, how do you bridge from like, if this is what people are saying about us and this is where you want it to be, like here are all the things that you need to happen. And if you ask me what are the things that contribute to us being seen and perceived as an employer of choice, I think I call out three things. I call out leadership's vision. Our leadership was very clear. Our CEO in particular was very vocal about the kind of institution he wanted to have and how he wanted people to work together and how he wanted us to be recognized amongst external stakeholders and internal stakeholders. He always talks about people's first, like we will do the deals. I have no doubt about doing the deals, but our people are our most valuable asset. Like if you ask anyone at Mubadala, they'll tell you that statement like with their eyes closed, because that's what he repeats all the time, our people. So I think leadership is a big part of that, and the ability to articulate a purpose. We all are so passionate and committed to the purpose of like, what are we trying to do as an institution? We are trying to support the government of Abu Dhabi on this mandate of diversifying our economy and being a global player, and therefore being clear about what we want to do and how we want to do it. And we want to be progressive, and we want to be global, and we want to be innovators in the process. People were more than willing to get behind that and believed in the cause. And I think that's what's helped drive everyone's commitment and loyalty and passion towards it, because everybody was working towards the same thing. So I'd say leadership, I'd say purpose, and I'd say our values. Again, another statement that our CEO constantly repeats is, if we do things in line with our values, the chances of us getting this wrong are like minimal to none, because we live true to our values. During COVID time, number of institutions were scrambling, trying to figure out what to do for their company and how to do it. We were not swayed by policies. We were not swayed by pressure of like what other institutions were doing. We were like, what's right for our people? So as a policy would come out, our leadership would rally behind that and say, okay, right, this has come out globally. This has come out from a government perspective. What do we want to do? And we would say, actually, that doesn't work. Or we'd say, some of this makes sense, but we would need to, we need to have not a cookie cutter approach to these other cases. We'd need to be a little bit more empathetic. We need to be a little bit more hands-on. And our leadership were like, do it. You know, so I think that plays a big part in terms of being recognized at a place, as a place to work, is that we really think of our people first. We think about what's right for our people, doing it in a way that makes sense, living true to our values. And then from there, I think it all just kind of comes together. And I think it all just kind of supports each other, because again, you've got that skeleton, you've got your principles in place. So that's been, I think, one of the biggest attributes to us being this organization.
I know you've also been considered one of the greatest innovative companies across the Middle East. And how does that relate to all of this?
It's an honor to be seen in that way. And I think it is, again, a people's first. You know, arrogance can get in the way of it all. So, you know, when our leaders are working with partners, we are really instilled with their partner, work with people, build on everyone's areas of expertise, and then come back with a solution that makes sense, that's right. So I think, how did we get there? It's about people. It's about picking the right leaders. It's about investing in your leaders. It's about investing in your team, coaching, giving opportunities for people to, you know, shadow, for people to make mistakes, for people to learn from those mistakes. I think all of those things contribute to being seen as like, you know, innovators or the organize in the Middle East about, in terms of like thought leaders in that space, because we do it in a, I'm calling on my CEO a lot, so you can tell how much he really instills a lot on us. You know, he says, partnerships, work with people, and come back with what makes sense. He says that a lot of the times, like, we can't do this alone. We need to figure out how we partner with others to get the best outcome. And again, if we're pushed in that way and we're working with our values, I think it naturally just brings out the best in us.
It's great. You know, I'd like to switch direction here a little bit. And I'd just like to ask you about what it's like to be a woman in the UAE. You know, I know the role of Emirati women such as yourself has changed drastically. And or you can tell me if you even agree with that. But I'd just love to hear about that journey.
Yeah, it's been a fast journey. I remember, so I was different. My mother worked, so it was different. But a lot of women in my mother's generation were not necessarily working. And therefore, there were a few women that really set the tone in terms of, like, we can go into the workforce. But I think, again, I go back to what that was built on, which is, again, the fundamentals of the country. Our leadership have always said women contribute to the solution. You know, His Highness Sheikh Zayed, who passed away and one of the founders of the country, the rule of the country, used to say, like, women are part of the ecosystem. You cannot solve a situation on your own. You need to integrate women into their workforce, into the solution, into our environments, and make sure that they're playing their role. And I think that kind of thought ideology set the tone, encouraged women to therefore then take their place, and more and more women were taking the risk of wanting to work and wanting to contribute in a meaningful and impactful way. And you're seeing today, some of the statistics, I don't have them on me right now, but you're seeing in universities that women are much higher in numbers than men are in universities. When you're seeing top students in most, as they're coming out of universities, majority of them are women that are playing that role. They just, you know, you're seeing that their drive is there, their innovation is there, their commitment is there. And that comes and translates into the workforce. That definitely translated in me. I was very blessed to always have champions and fathers and brothers who were always like, why don't you apply for that role? Like, of course you should take that role. Like, you should give it a shot. Like, what could be the worst thing that could happen? You'd get rejected and then what, you know? So I think the narrative has definitely changed. People are pushing for more and more women to take very senior roles. And today, again, I don't have the statistic with on me, but we're governed by ministers and in various bodies. And we have women that make up half of the minister population today. And therefore, you are definitely seeing that shift.
I mean, it's so fascinating to me how quickly everything moves in the UAE. You know, I think about just what you were describing in terms of just the last couple decades. And in the U.S., it took us much longer, I think, to get there. And I think about just even the infrastructure of the country, the culture of the country, how progressive it's been. It's remarkable.
You know, you're right, Marilyn. Again, it's so easy to take it all for granted because it has been. It's been a push from our leadership. It's been a push from the government. They've taken an active measure to encourage women to be out in the workforce. So it's been something that we've been really driving towards in terms of encouraging people. We saw that there weren't many women in taking over private roles. So there were women working, but there weren't necessarily many women taking over roles in private institutions. And that's where we really wanted to push, because that's where you really see the innovation. So the government worked very closely with leaders in order to try and push policies that enabled, you know, if you're going to create a body, if you're going to create a council, 50% of the council has to be made up of women. If you're going to create a policy in workforces, you need to think about your women population and think about how it's supporting them. So there's been a big drive in terms of the consideration and how to build that infrastructure that would allow women to succeed in some of these senior roles.
I'd just be curious to get your thoughts on something women all over the world struggle with, and that is, you're a mother of three children and an executive at Mubadala. How do you really balance all that?
How long do you have? I feel like that should be a separate podcast all on its own. I think as I've matured, I realize that actually it is a balancing act. You know, a lot of the time, and I say this a lot to women in my team, there's a notion of you can have it all and you can do it all. I think the most important part of that realization, or maybe that narrative, is to understand everything is at a cost and at a price. And you need to be thinking about the support that you put in place in order to allow yourself to do it, not guilt-free, but in a way that resonates with you, that allows you to feel like you can really balance it both. And let me explain what I mean by that. My kids will be the first one to tell you, I've never been involved in the bake sales. I've never been involved in sew your own costume. I've outsourced pretty much everything. And that's what it took for me to be successful, because I would be there for the events that mattered. I would be there for the school orchestras or sports days that were important to them. I didn't need to bake 50 cupcakes or 100 cupcakes and sew the costume. So for me, it's about thinking, what am I giving up? And I was okay not necessarily making those cupcakes. We outsourced them, and I, you know, maybe not the best value to be teaching my young ones, but hopefully what they saw was a role model that was trying to balance, and therefore I was able to do what I needed to do at work and then come home and spend quality time with them in the areas that mattered to them, not necessarily in all of the other extracurriculum. And I say that because I think it's such an important realization to share with people who are having young children trying to make careers. I'm not sure if everyone agrees with the thinking, but you know, I look at women in my institution that have very young kids trying to build their career, and they've built an infrastructure. They've got someone who picks up the kids every day. They've got someone who drops off. They figure out when can they actually do the pickups themselves, but they don't make it a given of like they can. There are contracts or negotiations, or you do need to strategize how you're going to make it work. And it doesn't just happen because you want both. You've got to figure out, I can't do pickup day, or you've got to figure out today, I can't do this meeting because I'm doing something else. And you've got to be able to know what you're giving up for the other and make up for it the next day. And it's a constant reset day by day. And if they're not resetting, you're going to have burnout. And that's what I keep trying to explain to the young mothers in my team, to be clear about where you're at. Do not just take the narrative as you're hearing and saying, I can do it all. It comes at a cost. And I'm not sure if many people can do it all. It's about thinking the how you do it and being clever and creative in terms of picking the things that are important and crucial that need you, and then making the rest work.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, my two daughters are now grown, but that's exactly how we got through it all. And, you know, what I remember is I used to always say to them, I will be at anything that you tell me is absolutely important. As long as it's really, really important to you, I will make it happen. And very few things ended up that important once they were able to make the decision. Because they, you know, we as mothers, I think, often think things are so important, and the kids keep moving on with their life. What they want to know, though, is we'll be there when it really matters to them.
Yeah. I 100% can't agree with you more. I used to have a contract with my kids every start of a new year. I'm like, each child, you pick your three activities that you really want me at. Tell me early and I will prioritize it. Come rain or shine, and I'll make that happen. And so each of them would have their pick, and they're three kids. So, you know, there were 9 big events that I was attending to within the year, be it their school concert or be it tryouts for whatever, you know, their basketball game. But for those 3 events that they picked, it was a contract. I agreed to it. It gets into my diary early. And that was the other thing. It was like, my kids know getting into my diary early.
So what's ahead for you that you're excited about?
I think as we have a new joiner who literally just joined 2 days ago, when I was having lunch with him today. And what I was saying to him was like, you, Mubadala is a kind of institution that every day feels different. Every time you think that you get your head wrapped around it, something else happens. So literally at where we are as an organization, I think what's ahead of me is I'm continuing to strengthen my team, continuing to build the capabilities and the competencies of the team in order for them to grow and to give myself room to get into new areas. As you go into the leadership space, what I'm learning is the leadership dimension is quite big, and therefore, if you're going to do the best version of yourself, it's how you prepare for the management committee meetings. It's how you prepare for seeing things 2 steps of the way to counsel and advise our leadership in a way that's impactful and meaningful. And you can't do that if you're busy in the weeds and working on everything day to day. So I think what's for me, what I see is ahead for me is the continuous change. As people grow, I think about the structure of the team, what's right, what gives people more challenges so they're learning and growing and they're excited to come to work every day, which gives me a little bit more room just to think about, right, what else is missing and how can we as comms be more effective than what we're already doing? We have been, I don't want to say lucky, we've worked hard to always be two steps ahead, to be thinking what's needed to counsel and guide our leadership through the most turbulence of time. You can't do that when you're stuck in the weeds and day-to-day tasks. So I'm looking forward to delegating more. I'm looking forward to building the team to, you know, build a communications team that really makes a lot of people proud to be a part of and makes others kind of, hey, you guys do this really well.
Well, that's the perfect segue to my last question, which is, you know, the title of this podcast is Let Go and Lead. And I'm curious, so what do you think leaders most need to let go of?
Control. And that's a learning for me too. You've got to let go. You've got to try not to think that you've got control of it all. Obviously, you need to be on top of things. Obviously, you need to be aware and strategic and proactive and all of it, but you can control how everything transpires. So in order to be effective, in order to continue to be innovative, you've got to let go a little bit and allow the organic to happen and then be opportunistic to take it to the next level.
Well, thanks, Umeima, and thank you so much for this conversation. It was really terrific. I really appreciate you doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so thankful to Umeima for joining us today and sharing her valuable perspectives. It's been fascinating to me how quickly the UAE is innovating. I enjoyed hearing that the government worked closely with private businesses to create policies supporting women leadership. I thought it was fabulous. Umeima played an instrumental role during the merger between Mubadala and IPIC, and I loved hearing the fascinating journey of how these two institutions came together. A few key points stood out. It wasn't just a merger, it was an integration, a deliberate effort to combine the best of both worlds. They emphasized up front that nothing was broken in these organizations, but rather they wanted to cultivate a culture that would nurture a better version of themselves. And Umeima reminded us that true transformation lies not just in the mechanics of merging entities, but in the mindset, language, and commitment to growth. And since the title of this podcast is Let Go and Lead, I asked her what leaders should let go of. Without hesitating, she said, control. To be innovative, you've got to allow the organic to happen and then be opportunistic to take it to the next level. That's so insightful. I gleaned so much from this conversation with Umeima and hope you did as well. Remember to subscribe to Let Go and Lead on your favorite podcast platform and be the first to hear conversations and ideas from other thought-provoking leadership champions, including Kate O'Neill, Mark Miller, and Bonnie St. John. And don't forget to check out our archive interviews with Marshall Goldsmith, Howard Schultz, Seth Godin, and others. Thanks for joining, and see you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.